I'm Anita Lustria, and this is Faith Conversations. Today, I am excited to have around the kitchen table Catherine Willis Pershey. And I have been very interested to read her book. There's been a lot of buzz about it, and now I know why. For good reason. It is beautifully written, extremely thoughtful, and if you have, well, if you're married or single, it doesn't matter. It's a great read. It's called Very Married, Field Notes on Love and Fidelity. But here's the deal. If you, like I do, have a kid who's engaged to be married, it is a book to pass on to anyone who is moving that direction, I think, and something that will really just strengthen what already exists in your own life or what's struggling to exist if you're in that place of struggle in marriage, which happens to all of us if you're married. But I love what Eugene Peterson said at the beginning of the book in the foreword. It is, without question, the very best book on marriage that I have ever read, and I have read many. Huge words from Eugene Peterson. Well, let me introduce you to Catherine Willis Pershey. If you're unfamiliar with her, Catherine is author of Any Day, A Beautiful Change, and she's an associate minister of the First Congregational Church in Western Springs, Illinois, which is a Chicago suburb, for those of you unfamiliar with the Chicago area. She's an ordained minister in the Christian Church, Disciples of Christ, with dual standing in the United Church of Christ, and her work has appeared in the Chicago Tribune, Christian Century, The Art of Simple, and the anthology Disquiet Time. And she and her husband, Benjamin, have two daughters who are adorable. I will just say that. So, Catherine, welcome to Faith Conversations.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you about Very Married. Number one, I don't know how you got Eugene Peterson to write not just the foreword, but it, you know, high praise from a guy who, as he said, has read lots of marriage books, just lots of books in general. Pretty exciting to read that, isn't it?
It was so exciting. I don't think I've yet fully recovered from the mere fact that he said yes to the invitation to write the foreword, let alone what he wrote in the foreword.
Well, he went on to say, Very Married is the book I wish I had had when I was counseling soon-to-be-married couples years ago. The book that would have helped them think through the covenant of sacrifice and gladness into which they were entering. So, yeah, great, great words. I am really curious, why marriage? I mean, there are all kinds of books that, especially someone who's a pastor, can write, you know, topics, theological persuaded books, and not that that's not a part of Very Married, but why a book on marriage? What for you, what's the passion behind writing about this?
Well, I had tried to write something not personal for my second book. I set out to write a series of biblical narratives, sort of short stories based on New Testament stories. And that didn't go anywhere. My intention was to write something that wouldn't feel scary and vulnerable and personal. And yet, here we are with a book that is scary and vulnerable and personal. But it really is what I felt most called to write about. Marriage is the fundamental fact of my life. It feels as critical to who I am as a person as it's right up there, right underneath my identity as a child of God. I was married at 22, and so really had the opportunity to grow up with my husband. And I've had a hard marriage, but a good marriage. And it just increasingly became clear that that was what I had a lot to say about. And so when the invitation came to write this book, I tried to say no, but had to say yes.
I love it. How about the title, Very Married?
A friend of mine.
Sounds redundant.
Yes. A friend of mine suggested it. It's actually based on an Audrey Hepburn quote. She said, if I ever get married, I want to be very married. And of course, you know, you can't be a little bit married. You either are or aren't, but you know, you get what it means. Sort of a wholehearted commitment to the covenant of marriage. And that is certainly how I see my own marriage.
Yeah. Well, I know one of the things you say in the book, and I appreciate this, you know, you don't bring your pastoral role to bear in the sense that, oh, I'm an expert, you know, at all. You say that. You say, I'm not an expert on marriage, but I am a marriage geek. What do you mean by that?
You know, it became a sort of hobby to read books and watch. You know, I was always drawn to movies or shows that had interesting married couples at the fore. So just I don't know, it just sort of developed into a, I'd pay attention to how marriage is depicted in our culture and talked about in the church. And because it was such a huge part of my own life in both joy and struggle, just sort of the geekiness came to fore.
I love it. Well, you say in the book, I'm an apologist for marriage. And I like that statement. I think, I mean, that carries with it certainly some thought and some weight as well. I'm wondering, if I'm not incorrect, I think you're an introvert.
I don't know.
No?
I can be pretty extroverted.
Okay. All right. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, then scratch that. Regardless, how do you write so personally and not feel like you're wearing your, you know, like your skin has been basically cut off your body? You're just walking around raw, it feels like, mm-hmm. in a book like this. How do you manage that?
I do feel a little bit raw. And it is, as I said, I set out to write a book that would not leave me feeling as vulnerable as I feel about this book. I trust that the story I'm telling, I'm not telling for the sake of my story, but I'm really trying to do the work of testimony and let my story point to a bigger story and let it be of service. And I trust that thanks to, you know, great writer friends and my editors who were just phenomenal, I think I had the right help to make sure that we were shaping this book to be not my story for the sake of my story, but anything that's in there that is personal is there for a reason. And I think I had a pretty firm sense of what my boundaries should be and where to sort of draw the curtains and say this is private and not to be included on, you know, page 63.
Well, one of the things that you talk about, there are stories in the book of people in your sphere, and many of those you've either change the details or names, or, you know, but you kind of couldn't change the name of your husband in the book. So Benjamin is definitely prominent. And how did he respond when he read the book?
He sent me a text message. I don't remember where I was, but not in the room, apparently. And he said, this is the book that, you know, he always hoped I would write, or this is the book he wanted to be in, or whatnot. It was, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was the loveliest thing he possibly could have said to me at that juncture when I was feeling very worried about how he would receive it. He was actually the one who said several years ago, you should write about us. He did sense that our struggles could be redumptive if we had the courage to share them. And so he trusted me with our story. I could never be in his shoes. I need to be the one telling the story.
I love that. Yeah. Well, and you are, and you tell it well. I'll just say that. So, and kudos to Benjamin for signing off, because mm-hmm. I think that's no small thing. And I think the value of writing something that is so personal too for the reader, I think so many of us need to read a book like this and go, oh, thank you, God. I'm not the only one. Isn't that always that response that you're hoping will happen, that identification factor where people do no longer feel alone?
That is exactly how I see it. And I think that there's actually a great role on our bookshelves and our nightstands for sort of self-help books that give you really practical advice that isn't rooted in a sort of memoirish kind of book, which this is. It's not a straight memoir, but it uses memoir to serve the what I'm trying to do in talking about marriage. There's absolutely a role for those books, and I've read those books and learned from those books. But I think that people's lives and marriages are more likely to be transformed by conversations around a table. And that's what I am trying to do here, is offer that sort of friend telling a story that shifts your perception of your own relationship in ways that a self-help book never could.
Preach. I think you're exactly right. I think it's discouraging as you look at, you know, contemporary culture, even within the church, the divorce statistics. And not to make light of that, I'm sitting here talking to you as someone who has experienced a failed marriage. So, you know, I talk out of that kind of experience. But how can we not be so discouraged about that? Or are we too quick to send people packing? Or how, you know, there's that sensitivity that has to be there to marriages that are in the kind of distress that where they should not remain married. I'll say that. Mm-hmm. How do you strike that balance, and why is marriage also so easily thrown away for some of those not so deep, heavy reasons?
Writing about divorce was the hardest thing in a book about marriage, because I felt so deeply committed to marriage, and you know, we use the phrase the sanctity of marriage and the covenant, honoring that felt critical to me. But I absolutely could not entertain a conversation about divorce that wasn't rooted in grace and understanding and non-judgment. And so listening to stories of friends who have gone through that felt like the absolute necessary research to be able to speak with any authority to an area that I haven't experienced, although we did at one point consider separation. We walked away from that particular path. There's a tricky thing in our culture, and the sociologist Andrew Cherlin addresses it, where we have two competing beliefs about marriage that are totally in paradox. There's a tension there, and we often don't name it. The first is that marriage should be forever. You see that in our weddings, and the narrative is, you know, till death do us part. And we believe that that's how it should be. But we also believe that people shouldn't stay in marriages that are unhappy. And those are two
tensions.
I mean, there's definitely a tension there. As I say in the book, I don't think that a healthy way to honor the sanctity of marriage is to condemn people to a life of misery. I don't think that we should. I wouldn't apologize for marriage to the length of actually condemning divorce. I do think many marriages can be saved.
I think we sometimes confuse unhappy with unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but again, grace is, I think, always the word of the day. And I wish we used that on a whole host of issues within the mm-hmm. church, you know, that grace goes a long way. And I'm not talking, you know, we're not talking some easy grace. This is just critical to the life of Christ, is to exhibit and to exercise grace in situations like that. This. So, you know, really not much more that we can say about that, but I think mm-hmm. it's important. And I do appreciate that you talk about divorce and write on divorce. You and Benjamin had this consideration for a short period of time. As you said at the beginning, yours has not been an easy marriage or one without struggle. Which, is that every marriage, if we're honest?
I would think. I mean, there are people who say, you know, we don't fight, and we're, you know, that has not been my experience of marriage, but personalities are as they are, and some people are really easygoing. I mean, we have a somewhat difficult marriage because we are somewhat difficult people, and that's the way it's going to be.
Okay, so how much does self-knowledge, self-awareness aid in a quality marriage, even, you know, one with struggles? I mean, isn't that a significant piece, that I think a crucial piece?
Absolutely. And the work that we did together in marriage counseling and the work that we did separately through spiritual direction and therapy has been how God has worked a redemptive thread through our story, because we were very young and pretty immature, had some unhealthy patterns and tendencies, and just took them all out on one another because that was the person, you know, that was the person nearest by. And knowing ourselves and loving ourselves so that we could actually behold and love the other, that's been our journey.
Mm. How important is it to be able to say the words, I'm sorry, in the context of marriage? I mean, some of us have to learn that. It doesn't always come naturally.
Mm-hmm. It's critical, but so often I think we say it, but we don't live it. And so really a pattern of repentance and following through and not having the same argument over and over again with the requisite apology at the end. And that was what we did. We said we were sorry all the time. Okay. And we had a lot to be sorry for, but it was the reorientation of heart and the repentance that was critical for us.
Yeah, saying it's one thing, living it is another. I love that distinction. Appreciate that distinction.
I think of that because we also always say I love you, but we mean about 45 different things when we say it. Sometimes it's I love you, and that actually means this conversation is over for now.
Yeah, I love that.
So
that's good.
It really good. Matching our actions with our words.
Well, and I think it's also our lack of English, you know, in the English language, love is, that's the only word where you go to other languages and you have more than one word. It's like, I love ice cream. I love my kids. I love my spouse. Okay. Three very different loves, right?
Yes. But so, ice cream is really very lovely. So
it's food of the gods. I tell people it's my favorite food. I want to bring in your role as a pastor. I've got to believe that stepping into that particular role in a church and very likely having people come to you in that marriage counseling kind of role has also influenced some of what's been written in Very Married.
It has.
Yeah, what has that looked like?
Yeah, I have to be very careful because I'm not called to, I am called to be a pastor and a writer, but I don't have carte blanche permission to write about what my parishioners might speak to me about. So there are a couple stories I tell where I specifically sought permission from the person and, you know, changed names and whatnot. I think it ends up informing the book in a broader way.
Well, I'm thinking of how it just informed you in your own marriage. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously we get the spillover of that in Very Married, but it's one thing to go through your own marriage struggles. It's another thing, maybe even to be in the midst of those with someone coming and sitting in front of you in the pastoral office.
Oh yeah. I've sat with some couples before their marriages and been highly aware of the argument that I just had with my spouse as I talk about healthy communication strategies for your marriage.
Well, it's always easier to talk to someone else about their stuff as opposed to be anywhere objective about our own, or it's so close. Yes. But I can imagine that in some ways has been, an interesting help. And I think also knowing, I don't know if you talk about this in the book or not, but knowing the ends of your own skills and when to send someone on. I've been in the past kind of wary of sending people to pastors because I've seen some disasters.
Yes. We really are not trained. I mean, some pastors are trained credentialed marriage and family therapists or pastoral counselors. You know, most pastors had a handful of classes in seminary and really would do well to refer parishioners to professionals when they reach the limit of their skill set.
Yeah, we're all fallible. I'll get out of my commentary mode here for the time being. I'm curious too, you know, as you look back, I mean, it's one thing to write this book from how many years down the road for you and your husband? 14, 15?
14.
14,
mm-hmm.
Okay. You know, it's one thing to write this book, and I appreciate that it's written at this juncture, you know, and not 2 or 3 years in, and, you know. But looking back, knowing what you know today, and even specifically living through the specific struggles and difficult points that you have lived through to this point, what might you have said to you at 22, maybe just before you got married? Would you have said, stop, don't do it? Or what kind of counsel might you have given?
I think this was the only way for us. I think that if we had held off, we also got married very soon. We were engaged 3 months into our courtship and married within the year. And I do kind of wonder why nobody was trying to stop us. I mean, I was really young. He was somewhat 5 years older, but still a newly recovering alcoholic. I mean, we were waving the red flags left and right. And I've said to him that I think if we had held off, if we had said, oh, we'll wait a year, I'll take a year off before I go to graduate school. Part of why we were kind of pushing the marriage forward was so that we could be together. We moved to California from the Midwest right after our wedding. If we had waited, we would have argued.
You might not have been married.
We either would have called it off or I don't think we would have gotten married because we needed the covenant to get us through those incredibly difficult years together. And honestly, I'm not saying that marriage is the only way to grow up. I think that's a misnomer. That's a mischaracterization, and it's unfair to the many fully adult single people who have
sure,
had
absolutely.
Other paths to yes. maturity. My path to maturity, I needed the covenant of marriage to take me through. So I'm glad we did what we did. We didn't take an easy route, but I really think it was the only route that would have made sense and led us to this place of real gratitude and redemption.
Two thoughts that come out of that response. One, I want to go back and talk about millennials and their waiting mm-hmm. today, but in moving to California, getting married and making that cross-country move, really, were both of your families here in the Chicagoland area, or at least further east? Did you move and you were there kind of as an island, just yourselves? Was that a help or a hurt? What do you think?
In some ways, it meant that there was a chance for us to have our own place and our own island, as
no,
you say.
No interference, as
yeah,
they
but,
say.
I mean, it was really difficult. I was in seminary right out of college. I went to seminary, and that's its own crucible.
Oh, yeah.
I had a wonderful best friend in seminary who continues to be my best friend to this day. And she was a huge help to both of us, me most directly, but she was a friend to Ben, too. And she, you know, it can be hard to be a friend to your friend's difficult husband or your friend's difficult wife.
Yes.
And again, I'm just as difficult, yeah, to be clear, not throwing him under the bus. But she was such a good friend to us. So we weren't alone. Mm-hmm. But that added to the sort of total rupture of what we had been before marriage and who we were and where we were as a married couple.
All right, let's go back to the millennial piece. I'm curious because I have a millennial, and while he's engaged to be married, and not married right out of college, but 2 years of grad school, getting married at the end of his second year of grad school. And a lot of millennials, and that's actually kind of young, he'll be 24 actually, but a lot of millennials are waiting much later to get married. What are your thoughts on that? Good or bad, or is it neither?
I don't know. I mean, I know that it's very rare for anyone to be married as early as I was these days. I mean, I grew up in an area where a lot of people got married right after college, so I didn't realize what an outlier I was, and I'm sort of in that micro generation in between Gen X and millennials. I can't imagine having...
You're special, in other words.
Yeah. Exactly. We like to think of ourselves as very special.
Yes.
I can't quite imagine living out my 20s as a swinging single. It wasn't ever something I wanted. So it feels so radically different than my own experience. But I certainly can't say, oh, well, that's the wrong way to do it. But I mean, it does mean you end up, if you're going to have children, with less time in between when you marry and have kids. You know, a lot of people would get married and then wait 5 years and then have kids. So you have less time to settle in. It means you've been an adult a lot longer and sort of have your ways rather than have the experience of growing up together into who you'll be.
Yeah.
Most of the couples I marry these days are close to 30. So I certainly see that as a pastor. And it's not good or bad, just very
it just
different.
Is. It's just different, yeah. Yeah, you either have time on one end or the other. Right. I look back to my mom doesn't like it when I share this, but I don't think she listens to the podcast. But, she was 16 when she married and had twins at age 18. Talk about growing up fast.
That would make you grow up pretty fast.
Yeah. And also a different era. And I would even say that in that era, she was much more adult at that age than probably the typical 16-year-old today. You know, so that's a piece of that as well. What's happening in the world and generationally, there are a lot of factors in there. But I think it's interesting. One of the things you also talk about vulnerably in the book is attractions to others. And I think I am grateful that you talk about that. I think that that's inevitable. You know, it's something that will happen, but what we do with that, you know, how do you talk about it?
Well, as I say, I read and watch a lot of stories about marriage, as we all do, because once you start paying attention, you see that it's sort of often the narrative. And the narrative is often one of adultery. I'd be interested to know what percentage of, you know, great works of literature, great films involve an affair.
Good question.
It almost feels like a cliche, and yet we keep telling that story. And so for me, I do think that it's very common and normal for people to encounter someone that they're drawn to, that they're attracted to. And if the only narrative we're hearing is a ruinous affair, that doesn't give us an alternative way to imagine
what it looks like.
It doesn't give us a vision for walking away.
Right.
And so that was really where the book started. I wrote about this experience, and ultimately it caused me to lean into my marriage, not to turn away from my marriage. And telling that story, I realized, was critical, because I wanted to put forth just a single counter narrative to what it looks like to be honest and to be faithful in the face of temptation.
That's big, and I think significant, and I'm really glad you talk about it. I think a lot of people deny that piece, and that's just not reality. And there's nothing wrong with being drawn to other people. It's the, you know, it's the outworking of that, or the, yeah.
And there's so many ways that it can go south. I mean, mm-hmm. many people do avoid a physical infidelity, but emotional affairs are easier to have than they used to be, because the internet really allows for that. I mean, there, it's like a playground. Facebook can be, I'm not saying it's dangerous and evil, but it can be used in ways that are detrimental to our covenantal relationships. Yeah.
Things that didn't used to be at our disposal are available. I'm also very interested, and I don't know how much you want to talk about this. You write about this, but you talk about the sexual relationship. It's like, oh, here we go. And I am really appreciative of that as well. I'm someone who grew up in evangelical circles, and while I didn't grow up with the purity culture, that's something that I've seen through the growing up of my son. He certainly did grow up through it, though I don't know how much it touched him, but it has always disturbed me as a woman. Mm-hmm. Especially. And so, well, yeah, talk to us. I don't even know what I want to ask. Can you tell?
Oh, Anita, you had to go there.
Like, I don't know.
Well, it's funny that I'm a contributor to the Christian Century, and we had sent them a copy of the book. And of course, the chapter that they very graciously accepted to excerpt in on the cover, nonetheless, of the new issue, and just went up today, or this week, actually, is of course the chapter on premarital sex. Just because, you know, I, who wanted to be invulnerable in my next book, we're just going to make sure that the most embarrassing chapter gets online too.
Yes.
But I'm of course thrilled, because I don't approach it through a purity culture. I don't approach it through, well, this is the right way, this is the wrong way. I really sort through my experiences, the joys, the pain, the journey to understanding why we might argue, I don't want to even say argue, why we might understand that marriage is the safest place for sexual intimacy to unfold. And so, I mean, I was kind of, I mean, this is a terrible verb to use in this particular conversation, but I'm going to say that I was groping my way through the dark. How often does that happen?
That's great.
In these conversations, Anita?
That's hilarious.
But I was grappling with the issue without trying to be judgmental, without trying to put forth yet another narrative that's just going to hurt people. But again, to tell my story in a way that I hope sheds light on how other people might discern their own sense of sexuality in marriage or outside of marriage.
What is the most important, or what has not yet been said here today in our conversation? What is something you really want people to take away from Very Married, or want them to know about what is inside the covers of this book? Again, Very Married, Field Notes on Love and Fidelity. Any final word from you that people just need to know? It might even be a reiteration of something you've already said. But is there something that you think is the most important thing that you've said?
I think that God is at work in our lives in creative and beautiful ways. Mm. And that one of those ways that God can work is through marriages, even difficult marriages.
Well, pretty powerful, and I think, and true, and just plain old true. Catherine, I am delighted that you came to the kitchen table here, and I cannot recommend Very Married highly enough. I said it at the beginning, I'll say it again, beautifully written, lovely foreword by Eugene Peterson. You've got Glennon Doyle Melton endorsing it, Sarah Bessie, Seth Haynes. A lot of great voices coming alongside and saying, read this. And I'm adding my voice to that chorus. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Anita. It's been wonderful to talk to you.
Really, really appreciate it. I've enjoyed it as well. I'm Anita Lustria, and this is Faith Conversations.